Welcome, everybody, to Mormons on Mushrooms. Just a reminder that this is a storytelling podcast where we discuss alternative methods for healing from trauma and seeking a more fulfilling life. A lot of times on the podcast, we discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health top priority. Lastly, the opinions offered by our guests don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts. Sit back, buckle up, and enjoy.
This is the first time we've done one of these things.
I know. It's like, I was so ready to, like, I knew exactly how we were going to talk and what we were going to say. But then I just saw you and I was like, oh, I just want to kind of chat with Mike.
Well, I mean, I think we can just chat for a minute before we get to introducing our guest this week, which is Planned Parenthood, which was an amazing conversation.
I mean, amazing. These two, they knocked my socks off. Planned Parenthood. First of all, great name.
I mean, I feel like we could have chatted with him for hours and hours, and maybe we'll bring him back on at some point. In fact, we were like, let's chat for hours. And he's like, no, it's time to go to bed. I'm like, okay, yeah, I get it.
He shut us down. I feel like Rebecca was like, okay, let's keep going, you know, but yeah. I was like, oh no, it's late. It's bedtime.
But before we get into that, I just want to see your face today.
I mean, it's brighter than I usually have in the day, you know?
And maybe this is a spoiler for, or a teaser for next one. I finished watching E.T. I watched E.T. yesterday for school.
E.T.?
Yeah. I was like halfway through and I'm like, why am I watching this? And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I get it.
Whoa, dude, really? What do you mean? I don't think I've seen E.T. since I was a kid.
Well, we can go down this path just for a minute. Then we'll introduce Planned Parenthood and we'll kick it off. But like, yeah, I was having that moment of like, why, how does this tie into psychology? What is it? And then I don't know. I thought about being a kid that age and like feeling a little alien in this world, you know, like, yeah. Well, at that age too, it's because he's clearly prepubescent in that film based on his voice, Elliot. Right. And so he, yeah. So it's almost like E.T. is this encounter with his unconscious self, this part that feels alien, that doesn't feel at home in this world. And he has to say goodbye to it, to grow up. You know, you have to have that split of the unconscious. That part of him had to go back home. Well, he had to be in reality for a while. You know, everything's going on with his dad and his dad's in Mexico with Sally, fucking Sally, you know, whatever. And he's growing up, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, just thinking of the times, that childhood time when you're in your imagination and everything's bigger than life. And then you have to say goodbye to that for a time and live in the world. I mean, at least that's what I think we did.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. I never even thought about it that way. Maybe that's a little preview for something we talk about in the next episode.
I think so too. And then, you know, maybe it ties into, you know, I don't know, maybe it doesn't tie into Planned Parenthood at all, but I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, it kind of does though, because their whole thing is opening up a dialogue and creating a safe space for families to talk about some of this stuff, right? Some of these healing modalities. So I like that we're doing this. So just, you know, for anybody who's listening, one of the hardest things about the podcast is trying to work in an introduction to our guests, because we like to just drop you in to the middle of our conversation. Because we feel like the conversation is the thing. We really enjoy those conversations and want you to be a part of it. And then a lot of times we get caught up in like, oh, well, introduce yourself and tell us who you are and all that kind of stuff. But we're here at the beginning of the show to introduce them for you so that you know who we're talking to and what they're all about.
Yeah. So Planned Parenthood is an organization. I think they're largely online, but I think they're going to start doing more in-person events now that COVID is doing its ebbs and flows. But yeah, hosting online workshops and online kind of share circles, similar to what we do in our Mighty Networks community for, you know, parents who, you know, we get these questions a lot, especially in our ex-Mormon community about how to navigate plant medicine and parenthood and all the issues that come up with that, especially, you know, speaking to your kids about it or even with the residual shame of, am I being a good parent? I'm seeking my own healing. And yet you still feel like, am I being responsible? Am I being a responsible parent? And I think we hit on a lot of these themes in this episode.
Yeah. So we're talking to Rebecca and Andrew from Plant Parenthood. And the two of them are awesome. We had not met them before. Peter, who does a lot of he's the producer for our podcast. He had interviewed with them and chatted with them. And they are so radical. I think towards the end of the thing, I just tell them both I have the biggest crush on them. And you can probably hear it throughout the episode that I am just in love with both of them. They're just so connected in the way that they approach their life with their kids and with their family. They're incredible. This is a fun one.
Same. And if we don't meet them in person someday, we messed up somewhere along our life path. We'll have to redo our whole life over again, probably, to get to that path. But
I'm serious. I'm into going to the Horizon thing that they mentioned.
What's that?
You know, they mentioned the Horizon conference.
Yeah.
I'm definitely interested.
I looked it up that night. It doesn't look too not doable.
So to be continued, we may do that and give a reporting. We will return a report.
Well, in the meantime, I mean, anything else we want to plug before? I mentioned the Mighty Networks community. I do want to just highlight that for those who are listening and want to join us in our online community. It's community.mormonsonmushrooms.com. It's a beautiful place to also speak with other ex-Mormons. We even have people who are not ex-Mormon in there. Yeah. And are other people just kind of navigating the same shit you're navigating? And so, yeah.
Yeah, and the Mighty Networks has replaced for me a lot of some of the healing work that I do for myself. It's become part of my practice. There's just some powerful beings on there who do courses through the Mighty Networks. Mike, you've got a dream work coming up. That I'm really excited about. We've done ecstatic dance. We've done guided meditation. We've done breath work. We've done sharing circles. And I think it's just going to keep growing. More to come.
Yeah. One other thing, just Missy, who edits some of we'll be editing this episode. She's going to be hosting in early December through our Mighty Networks, she's a DJ. So she's hosting a DJ trippy music session. So yeah, a lot of fun things happening there.
And eventually I'll host one that, you know, I don't bring a lot of, there's not a lot of what I could host or bring to the table, but I think I could bring just, I don't know what to call it, but just a general how to better help people feel the love that you have for them and make them connect with you and what that looks like and what, you know, how to get rid of some of the insecurities that we have in public and in social settings and stuff like that. I'm going to do that sometime, Mike.
That is you. That is, could just be a let's all bask in Doug's presence for now.
No, it'll be things I've learned along the way.
Well, sounds good. Well, sit back and enjoy Plant Parenthood.
I don't know if you can call it research. Internet, I Googled you. That's my, yeah.
Cool. I was enjoying this conversation, so I just hit record. And
that's fine. We'll see
where we and then I just stop.
No problem.
But I had this similar experience. So I was telling Andrew and Rebecca earlier that, I watched the Zoom interview that you guys did, and I kept feeling like, oh, I want to ask this question and chime in here. And so now we get the opportunity to. And so thank you for being here and thank you for your time. We always say on the podcast, we hit record and then we can always cut anything out we want to, right? Mm-hmm.
We never really cut anything out. We just have this long form open conversation that ends up being this weird. We go in all sorts of weird tangents and we really are going to ask you questions, but mostly it's just going to be storytelling and we want to hear your stories. And that's pretty much kind of what this ends up being.
Andrew likes tangents.
Yeah.
Well, hold on a second now, Rebecca, you said Andrew likes tangents. So would you prefer no tangents?
No, I'm just making fun of him.
Yeah, okay. I will. I can go off. I'm not careful. Although, sometimes you go off and that's where the gold is. So
yeah,
I'm usually pretty good about finding my way back to where we were, unless I've been smoking cannabis. In which case it's 50-50.
And then there is no way back. I mean, the way back is the way forward, right? I mean, that's the beauty of cannabis. I don't know if I just said anything there. I probably said something that was total bullshit, but I think that's where the story lies. Uh-huh.
Do we have high Andrew with us tonight or
No. I'm actually not a big cannabis fan to be honest. I mean, use it occasionally, but also usually 50-50 in terms of whether I think it was a good idea that I did that. But Rebecca likes to tease me about it sometimes.
That's my heart medicine.
Same. Holy shit. Yeah, same.
Sometimes it is for me, but sometimes it makes me paranoid as fuck.
Yeah.
I found it more recently, even. Like, it was my jam for a while, and now, I don't know. It's like, I have to be careful with it. Sometimes I'm just like, feel the fear. Just like, sit there with it, right? Or I don't know. Maybe I'm doing it too much alone. I need to be doing it in groups more.
Right? Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, one of my issues with it, I can get sometimes the paranoia or the anxiety can come on if it's too much THC, but it is the divergent thinking. And if I'm in conversation, I have a much harder time, like, really actively listening, and the short-term memory is just not as high functioning. So I'll get into a thought and it'll lead to another thought, and I'll go off and not really make my way back, and then realize the other person has said something and I just missed it. So and then you get anxious about that.
Yeah.
And blah, blah, blah.
I had a quick experience, and we'll get to the good stuff in a second, but I just want to tell this experience real quick. I was going to a birthday party for one of my daughter's friends, and my wife was out of town. And so it was just me taking her, and I was like, you know, the birthday party was near the weed shop. And so, like, I'm going to get some weed and go. And then I was getting there, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to hit this pen one time, just one time, take the edge off. And that was a powerful pen. And I'm like, as soon as, like, I exhale in the car, I was just like, oh shit, I'm in trouble. And I kind of walk into the birthday party, and just exactly what you're saying, I'm having all these conversations with people, and I don't remember what I said a minute ago or where we're at. And so finally I decided to kind of flow with it. And it led to some cool conversations, though. Like, my friend's dad was there, and he's kind of always been a kind of a difficult person for me to chat with whenever I see him at one of these birthday parties. Kind of very right-wing conservative. But he sat down, and we all of a sudden were talking about aliens and Pleiadians, and we were vibing it like this soul level that I think the weed enabled me to, like, feel his soul and his energy and vibe and start communicating in that way. We were, like, talking about past lives, and I didn't know he was into any of that stuff. And I don't know if he consciously is, but somehow I was speaking to his subconscious at that party.
Dude, I love that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Found the tie that connects.
Yeah.
The other day, my wife and I were at a thing, and she turned to me suddenly and kind of gave me a look, and she goes, "Are you high?" And I was like, "No." And she goes, "Oh, you seem very normal right now. And usually the most normal you seem is when you're high." I'm like, oh, I guess I'm getting better at life because I'm not high and I seem normal.
You're integrating.
That's right. I'm just letting the weed become part of me, and I don't need it as much anymore to know what it feels like to be in that space.
Well, that's enough about us and our stories. Let's get into you guys.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a podcast where we bring guests on and we just tell them our stories the whole time.
Okay.
Into it.
You two seem like you have a pretty good, like, rapport already. And, like, how long have you guys known each other? Did you guys get connected through Plant Parenthood or...
We've actually never met.
But
not in person anyway.
Not in person. So both of us are trainers with a company called Fluence, which is an organization that trains healthcare professionals and therapists mainly in harm reduction informed psychedelic integration. And then Andrew learned that I was working on Planned Parenthood and was like, I think you need help, which was very true. He's organized. Let me help you. And then we've been working on this project ever since.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a little more subtle than that. I became aware of the work that Rebecca was doing through mutual contacts at Fluence. And I just thought it was really cool. You know, I'm a parent, and, yeah, I think I reached out. We had met at some, like, team meeting, and I reached out. We just kind of chatted, and we the first thing we did was an event together. It was also at the time on the board of the Montreal Psychedelic Society, and Rebecca had done, like, an online workshop, I think, for another psychedelic society, and we sort of did an event together, hosted her there, and that was the start. It went really well, and then we just kind of kept collaborating and chatting, and that turned into us kind of running this kind of thing together, which has mostly been online integration circles, workshops, and then producing various kinds of content. Rebecca's done some writing and interviews of other sort of folks in the psychedelic community, leaders, and we're also parents who are speaking to these issues. And yeah, and we're going to, we'll, I'm going to go down to New York for the Horizons conference in December. We're going to finally hang out in person. So sort of a COVID connection story.
That's awesome.
I love it.
So maybe we should start with just the most obvious question is what the hell is plant parenthood?
Well, we on our boilerplate. we are a community of parents and families who are interested in the intersection between psychedelics, plant medicine, and the family structure. So our mission, our aim is to destigmatize this topic. And we do that by bringing people together in community, by writing and approaching hard subjects, by, you know, folding in some other perspectives that are not sort of our own. So non-Western perspectives on this topic.
Yeah, I'm generally giving folks a platform to talk about stuff that they might, you know, not have a space to otherwise when it comes to, you know, working intentionally, therapeutically with psychedelics, in the context of like being a parent or issues around psychedelic use in some cases of their, you know, children or older adolescent teenage children, and just how all that stuff shows up in families. You know, we hear a lot about it in terms of clinical context and individual kind of Western oriented treatment of mental health issues. And you hear about it in broader kind of community contexts, various kinds. But you don't hear about it as much in the context of family. And that's really kind of the linchpin that connects those two pieces. So we're trying to serve that, I think, that conversation and that need.
I was going to say, just it's really critical for, especially for our ex-Mormon community, because Mormons get married young and we have kids young and we tend to have a lot of kids. And, you know, me and Doug were no exception. I was married when I was 22, had my first kid at 24, uh-huh. Had three kids, which, you know, is pretty low, I guess, or maybe it's more average now. But basically what I'm saying is in our like Mormons on Mushrooms community, we get these questions a lot, like talking to your kids about psychedelics, or we have people who share like, you know, I really want to do it, but all this subconscious shame comes up about like, am I being a good parent? Am I falling off the deep end now? Am I being irresponsible by using these substances? And then also just the conversations around, we even had a question in the community this week, which I'd like to get to at some point, is how have psychedelics been used as kind of a healing some rifts between parent and child? And so we just get a lot of these questions because we're involved with so many people who are dealing with this now at a later stage of life and usually have a handful of kids or in second marriages where they both have kids. And so it's right up our alley, I guess. It's a great intersection.
So you both have kids, I think, that you mentioned, right? Do you mind me asking ages? Is that too personal? I mean, what? Okay, so
I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old.
And I have two boys. My eldest is going to be 13 next week.
Wow, okay.
The younger one is 8. And I was 27 when I had my first Mike. So maybe old. I would have been older on the older side in the Mormon community, but probably still on the younger side in terms of my peer group. But, you know, that's all kind of relative, you know, in terms of different times and history and different cultures and communities that we live in.
What age? So have you, I mean, I guess we're just digging in here. So do you talk to your children about the use of plant medicine or the medicinal benefits of working with psychedelics? I mean, your kids are younger than mine and I'm terrified to have these conversations. I got a 16-year-old who's, you know, she's around people, they're smoking weed and she's, I think, fairly, active with her own sexuality and stuff like that. But this is a topic that I'm terrified to talk to her about. So can we dive right in? And can you tell us what's going on here? Like what do I do?
Well, I'm tempted to ask you what you're scared of.
Yeah. I mean, I'll gladly answer that. I'm scared of, you know, Mike had mentioned the feeling of it's a danger zone of what will people think about me as a parent? What will my oldest daughter is quite a critical thinker in that she's got her own. I mean, she is her own person. And I have loved watching that about her. And she's just so opinionated and comes right at me. But we have a really good trusting relationship. And you know, she and I talk about everything. And this is that one little thing about me that's kind of a big part of my life that I get so nervous that she'll shut down or feel like I'm, you know, because she's been exposed to the DARE program and to the anti-drug campaign and to just say no and all that kind of stuff. And she's had friends who have, you know, tinkered with, you know, say LSD and had a bad trip, or I say dark trip. I don't say good or bad trip, but I worry about what she'll think of me. I worry about if she shares that with people and it becomes a little more known in the community. And then what they're like, will kids not be allowed to come to my house? Like all of those little stigmas I get nervous about. Mm-hmm. Like I deeply want to talk to her about it, you know, cause I don't want her to feel like it's like, oh, dad's on something similar to meth or, you know, something like that. So to name a few, those are my fears.
I think they're so legitimate, those fears. I mean, that what you're talking about is a real consideration. And when you're thinking about what kinds of conversations that you'd like to have, or in your case, that you're maybe wouldn't like to have, but maybe, you know that it might be time, thinking about how that's going to be received in your community is one of the huge considerations. And it may not be the difference between whether you tell your child or not, but it might be the difference between how much you tell your child or how you, you know, how you kind of frame the issue. Is this something that can be shared outside of the home, or is this something that is sort of a core belief system within your family? And since other families may not have the same belief system, we need to kind of keep it in the realm of the household. But I think one thing that we've learned from so many people, so many leaders in the field who we've spoken to, is just about, like, you know, your daughter has a wealth of information already. So that's a really nice place to start. And she also has a lot of misinformation, especially if she's gone through the DARE program. She's been exposed to some pretty, like, horribly inaccurate propaganda, right? That's coming from the war on drugs. And that's something that, you know, is important, we think, you know, is important for our kids to grapple with, think critically about where the source of their information, you know, is coming from and why they're getting that information as opposed to something that we give them. So, yeah, there's more to that topic.
What I'd add to that, Doug, too, is that she's going to come around to encountering more information one way or another. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind as you were talking was, you've got a podcast called Mormons on Mushrooms. Like, odds are she's going to figure it out, you know, one way or the other. And why not get out in front of that? If you've got that trust and that connection with her and it's strong, you're probably, you know, you want to do justice to that relationship. Tell her what you know. And be upfront with her about the things that you're unsure of or that are gray area, but also don't be afraid to then tell her that you think some things that others may assume or some things that she may have learned are, like, worth challenging. And, you know, keep that trust and that channel open. If you don't keep that channel open and then she gets that information elsewhere, she's going to be faced with this question of, like, whoa, well, who can I trust? Why didn't dad tell me that? Why is he hiding that? You know, so if you're internalizing that shame and the stigma, then you kind of, it perpetuates, right? So it's not always easy to do that. And that's, you know, I think the other point to acknowledge that Rebecca was trying to sort of speak to is, yeah, then there are these bigger systems and other expectations and community issues and implications outside the home, right, that are real and need to be considered. But you can have a conversation about that too, you know, about, like, this is how we talk about it. Not everyone this is how I talk about it in these contexts. Not everyone understands that, you know, you may have friends that think this or whatever, but here, this is what I know. This is what I think. And then you let her also continue to, you give her a chance to then learn for herself. At least she's got the information there, and the integrity of your relationship is intact. You know.
Yeah, but what both of you are saying is ringing so true with me, because I feel like it's that hit me pretty hard about like she's eventually going to find out, and then it becomes this thing of why is my dad not talking to me about it? And it's, you know, the writing's on the wall. She knows I have a podcast that's about being an ex-Mormon. She also knows that we are kind of the weird family in our area because of our religious and political affiliations and that type of thing, and kind of the way we view the world. And so it's almost like, gosh, as both of you are talking, I'm just like sitting here going, yeah, why haven't I talked to her about this? Like, it's, you make it sound like a much less scary conversation than I think I've built it up in my head. Mike, do your kids, what are your kids?
I was about to ask you, I don't know how you've kept it a secret from them. But I think it's because I've done more of the social media stuff. And so, so busy with school and work. And so, the podcast that like, I don't have time to cover my tracks. So yeah. I think they've seen posts. And so, so I have a 17-year-old, a 14-year-old boys, and then an almost 11-year-old girl. And when we first created our Instagram for Mormons on Mushrooms, immediately my then 16-year-old son starts following it, my oldest son. And I was like, how did he, what's going on? And I think there was some functionality where, since it was associated with my personal account, Instagram was using the two to recommend it to people. So he's got a recommendation, Mormons on Mushrooms. He's like, oh, that sounds funny, I'll follow it. So immediately I had to have a conversation with him. And then over time, you know, they just saw things and were asking questions, and I could tell they'd seen things and we're feeling a little scared probably. And you were talking about it a little bit, Andrew, and I think there's a point to be made that, and maybe this gets in a little bit too much with the woo, but we feel what people are repressing on an energetic level. And our kids pick up on that. And so if there's some sort of repressed shame or fear, they're going to pick up on it, and they might read it as something completely different. You know, they don't know. It's like, oh no, my dad has a podcast about, you know, they don't know the legitimate reasons, but they're just feeling that fear, that shame in it or something, and interpreting it through their own lens. So I've had to have the conversations with each of them, and all of them have been surprisingly well, good. They went well, you know, they were very open and hard a little bit. You know, my oldest had a lot of questions. You know, he's been through a lot, similar to your oldest, Doug, where he was Mormon for the first part of his life. He was baptized in the church. We get baptized at 8 in Mormonism. So we left when he was about 10-ish and maybe 9. So like soon after he was baptized. And so he's seen, grew up Mormon, had the rug pulled out from under him a little bit. So he felt wobbly there. He still wanted to go to church when we'd stopped, you know, and then saw us drinking and like, what's going on. And then, so he's just seen these changes. And so he had a lot of questions around safety, but he's also a fucking smart kid. And so I'm sure he went and did his own research, and the research probably proved everything I was saying to him. And so he's been great ever since. You know, I think that first conversation was scary for him. I don't know. So it's went well. And I don't know, have you guys had conversations with your kids? Rebecca, yours are a little young. I don't know what you've shared with them or not, but.
Yeah, I have shared with them. And it's interesting as we're sort of navigating this in different age groups. You know, Andrew and I have a son. Each of us have a son that's about the same age. And then I have a younger son as well. But, you know, it's hard to know what my youngest picks up on. I talk very openly with both of them, but sometimes I think he's like not quite listening. And then 6 months later, he'll sort of repeat something back to me. I'll be like, oh, okay, you did process whatever that was that I was saying. But definitely my older son, you know, where I sort of toggle is in between this space of what they are asking, you know, what they're asking of me, which is not much because it's not really in their world so much. This is not, I mean, they smell it when we walk around, they smell marijuana when we walk around Brooklyn, but it's not like there's no like second graders like dropping acid, you know, not as far as I know. So, so it's like what they ask of you versus what you would like to tell them. And so Andrew, likes to talk about the sort of like natural curiosity that your kids come to the conversation with. That's not really there so much with my kids. So I'm a little bit gentle with it, but I do frame the issue in a broader context. I talk to them a lot about substances in general, right? So like sugar is a substance, caffeine is a substance, marijuana is a substance, plant medicine, you know, mushrooms are a substance. And so each of these substances acts on our body in a different way. And then there are some substances that you use and they're challenging to stop using. So they can understand it in that kind of simplistic language, whether that's in their environment or not, not so much, although cannabis certainly is, and they do know about that. I also think that this becomes a broader conversation about a couple of different things. So it becomes a broader conversation about addiction and mental health, where, I mean, that certainly is in their environment. Like, right? We live in Brooklyn, so there are people who have, you know, trauma, addiction, mental health issues, and they're homeless, they're street homeless. So that's like something that we can kind of like, you know, frame it, they can see it. And we also talk about this in terms of race, so, and fairness. So if you use this substance, you're a lot, because your skin is white, you're a lot less likely to get in trouble and maybe even go to jail because you use it. But if somebody who uses it, who has black or brown skin uses it, they're way more likely to get in trouble. And so we're sort of inviting this broader social conversation about race, about mental health, about, you know, all these things by virtue of being open about these substances. It is hard to explain to a five-year-old about like the ultimate state. Like, that's not something that I really try to do so much, but we have some really cool interviews on our YouTube channel where people in our field have talked about how they've explained to really little ones about the altered state.
Yeah. I mean, what I want to say, and Rebecca alluded to it, in terms of like how I've talked to my kids about it. And it's really, I just try and be open and respond to the questions that they have as they come up. Sometimes there's this assumption when people are asking, like, how do you talk to your kids about this? There's this assumption that's made that there's like a confession to make, right? And I think that like, that's already starting from like a false premise. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with intentionally using certain substances to alter your consciousness, to, you know, connect with yourself, to connect with others, to like release trauma in the body, you know, like humans have been doing it for thousands of years. So this idea that like, you have to sit them down and be like, here's this bombshell we need to drop, is already buying into some other narrative that I think is invalid. So that's the kind of starting assumption, is like, there isn't some big secret to confess here, right? But I know, and I maybe for your listeners too, that like that's baked into a lot of ways of like dogmatic religious thinking. It's like, there's this thing that you're not supposed to do. So now we need to, but we are doing this thing. So now we need to like unpack the shame or the stigma around it, right? So I'm not saying the shame and the stigma is not real, but I'm just saying watch for all those subtle ways that you end up buying into that narrative. So for me, it's just, it's kind of like, this is my job, you know, like my kids are around or they're listening to me like in a meeting and we're talking about ketamine or we're talking about ayahuasca or, you know, whatever it is. And they'll have a question and I'll answer it, you know, or it's not like we're sit around and do psychedelics all day. So it doesn't really come up in that kind of context, but we've certainly have had folks in our like integration circles or what have you, who are, you know, maybe like for whom, you know, ayahuasca ceremonies are kind of an integral part of their identities or families, and, you know, whose children may be aware or even like present potentially during ceremonies. And I think it's important to not just assume that that's this thing that needs to be kept secret.
That's so good for our Mormon listeners. I mean, Doug, we were having this conversation over the phone yesterday about confession and how I mean, Mormons love, I mean, we don't love to confess. I mean, we do love to confess because it's been grilled into us. We hated confessing as a kid, but now it's like that guilt, that shame from confessing feels so much more comfortable to us than the fear, right? Yeah. And so,
well, it's what you know, right? It's an old, it's an old pattern that's familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's easy to heap that shame upon or something, or go with that energy of, hey, I want to confess or unburden myself in a way. And I just love that you brought that up, because I mean, even it's just a different energy when you bring it to, you know, bring in just in a way, I have nothing to be ashamed of. And also I loved how you talked about responding to their questions. I mean, it's what everyone will say, or experts will say about talking to your kids about sex is, well, respond to their questions. They'll be curious, you know, foster an environment where they feel safe to ask the questions and then respond to them. And I've noticed that even though maybe my first conversations with my kids about the podcast were sitting them down more and talking to them, it's opened up the door for questions afterwards. And it's actually my youngest who's had the most questions, and she'll come every once in a while. Like, Michelle, it's always about like, how's the podcast doing, Dad? How many listeners do you have? How many? And just kind of things that she's like, hey, can I draw? She wants to animate us, Doug, to like, she's doing animation. Yeah. And she wants to, but I'm like, okay, I'll find like a clip that she can animate us with, but that's appropriate.
That's like my kids. How many subscribers do you have? Do you know how many subscribers Mr. Beast has?
Yeah, that got to him, Mr. Beast, man.
He's a YouTuber.
He is a big old part of our household. And if I see one more of those videos, I'm going to go nuts. I don't know what the hell they're doing. Yeah.
See, this is the thing too. It's like kids are like, they're also not going to care that much. You know, there's other stuff they care about. And if you let the sort of that natural curiosity, proceed, there'll be a time then it'll come up and it'll show up, especially if it's something that you're kind of openly engaged and interested in. They may express an interest and have questions, but they also may not. And that's fine too.
And it probably also will rattle loose. Like we're talking about our upbringing. I mean, I still do have this, like this compulsive need to confess. There's something about, you know, Mike, you mentioned unburdening. It's for me, it's also like, better to confess than to be caught or something like that, or to be found out, you know? And then what happens is I have this deep desire to do some kind of confession, because it almost like alleviates my, you know, I'm able to basically project everyone else's reaction. And I kind of go into rumination. I go worst case scenario. Michael, you and I talked about this yesterday. I'm really good at projecting how every single person will react to me the way the worst case scenario voice inside of me reacts to that kind of stuff. I love the way you're framing this as it's not this thing of sitting them down and having the talk. You know, I had to sit down, you know, my kids and have the sex talk or whatever so that they weren't getting, but it's just about that open line of communication and you know, answering questions, speaking up when maybe there's some misinformation coming, or when, you know, there's been times when my kids' friends have gotten into certain stuff and I'm very open about, I don't think they did anything wrong, like talking about it that way, but I'm still not talking about it from a personal perspective. I'm just saying, oh, my opinion is, you know, that this and that. And that probably rings false to them. My kids know me really well, and it probably does feel like I'm hiding something. It's like those final years of Santa Claus, you know. It's kind of like, yeah, we all kind of get it, but we're not really talking about it just yet, you know. It's my youngest is 9, and he's going through that right now, the Santa Claus thing, and I guess it kind of feels the same way to me.
I can see it. It's funny. That's funny.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He knows. But he doesn't want to admit it. He doesn't want to say it out loud, because if he says it out loud and I confirm it, then there's some magic that he loses. And I think he kind of has a basic understanding of that. This podcast is not about the mysteries and legends of Christmas. Sorry about that. I just kind of went into.
Could be.
It's a good tangent, because Santa's a shaman, as we know, right?
Right. Hell yeah.
you know, the it's interesting, like the, this idea of like unburdening. We talk about that. Andrew and I talk about that sometimes with our confession. Confession is in a way like that's for you, right? That's for the parent, right? To feel better for yourself. And if that's what you need to do, then, you know, that's what you need to do. But also part of this conversation is for them. So you just talked, you, I think, Doug, you were speaking before about maybe your daughter having had some friends who had a difficult trip. I mean, you know, that's the sort of stuff that can theoretically be prevented, right? Like, you know, I mean, not all difficult trips, but trips where you are prepared, right? Versus trips where you're not prepared. Or, you know, talking to your kids about making sure you know what's in your substance or whether your substance is what you think it is. So when you have a teenager like that, the conversation in my mind, I think it becomes less about like, do you want to know this? And it becomes more about, you're probably going to do this at some point. I'm really not going to be able to stop you. And so when you do this, here's what I want you to know. First of all, A, that you can come to me and that I am a safe place. And B, these are the things that I'm going to draw a hard line in the sand about, right? Like, so our colleague, Dr. Julie Holland, she talks on our, in our interview about how she told her kids, no white powders, you don't know what's in them. Okay, fair enough. Right. But there's other substances where it's like, it's not a white powder, but like, can we help our kids, you know, if they're going to take MDMA, can we help them get it tested? Make sure it's what you think it is. You know, I don't know. I mean, that might be going too far for some parents, but I think the reality is like there is a piece of it that is for us. And then there's a piece of it that's really for them and for their safety. And we're not going to prevent this from happening, but can we prevent something more intense or traumatic from happening? Unsafe.
Yeah. So that. can we shift just a little bit here? Because I'd really love to hear about your childhoods and how you got to where you are now. I mean, what was your introduction to psychedelics? Andrew, I think that you were raised Mormon. Is that right? Oh, you were not. So neither of you have anything to do with the Mormon Church.
No.
Jewish.
Okay. Jewish. Okay. So I would love to hear about your. Like, what was your upbringing like? Was it a religious upbringing? And what kind of things did you go through to get where you are? And what? How did you get introduced to psychedelics? That's like a big old question. You should each take 20 minutes.
Lord, I don't even know if I know this about you.
You want me to go first?
No, I know this about you, Andrew.
Yeah, sure. So I was raised in a pretty secular, like Western secular household. You know, my father's father was Jewish. His wife was an Anglican. Actually, her great uncle was like the dean of Canterbury or something like that. So he was like high up in the Anglican church. So they had a big scandalous marriage and basically didn't raise my dad's family religious at all. I don't even think he really knew he was half Jewish till he was older. mother's side, a lot of, you know, English, Scottish, some French, Italian. And also, you know, I guess there's some Catholic and Protestant stuff there, but trickled down to my mom's family, you know, mostly lip service and not much else. So me and my sisters grew up in a very secular home, celebrating Christmas and Halloween and, you know, all of the kind of Hallmark, like consumerist holidays, which is really, let's face it, the dominant religion in North America is consumerism. and in terms of psychedelic, and you know, pretty open-minded household, progressive, but not like I don't know. I had to still do a lot of digging myself, and mostly it was just being a teenager and being hungry for like creative expression, getting into music and, you know, meeting older friends. And like, I don't know, like Jerry Garcia and Leonard Cohen are kind of like my religious icons and continue to be like my bodhisattvas. I did become a Buddhist later in life and still consider myself one. But I even and think of Buddhism as a real religion of practice for me more than anything, and totally aligned with consciousness expansion and alteration. I mean, meditation is a practice that can shift your consciousness to non-ordinary states, you know, if practiced in certain ways. And Tibetan Buddhism, which is a tradition I've studied and practiced most in, you know, has really, really old roots that involve esoteric practices of all kinds. It probably also included ingestion of psychedelic substances. And we're seeing this more and more emerging in this sort of narratives around the like history of human religion and how embedded psychedelics have been in them. There's a wonderful book that came out, I think it's last year, called The Immortality Key, that I encourage your listeners to check out, by Brian Rescu, that's about really the origins of antiquity and ancient Greece and the Unish industries, and how they were probably consuming a psychedelic beer that contained a fungus, probably similar to LSD, and that the early sort of Christian groups were also, you know, consuming wine that was psychoactive. And like the history of religion is really co-evolved, I think, with psychedelics, and kind of forgot that, at least in the West for a long time. This is, you know, there are other threads here in terms of the Mazatecs and various, you know, indigenous tribes in South America in terms of ayahuasca, that like where that thread has kind of been preserved, but we think of it as coming from these sort of other cultures. But I really think human history going back a really long time, like altering our consciousness intentionally in community and family, has been a core part of like healing and staying connected, and also having like a personal connection with the divine, with God, and like the earth. Like I consider myself a spiritual religious person. I don't think there's any need to divorce like use of psychedelics from having that sort of deep spiritual like hunger and connection to the divine. If anything, like it enhances the whole thing. It shows you what like they're actually talking about in any of these sort of like really moving religious texts. So I went on a bit of a tangent there in terms of my background, but yeah, I mean, music, I don't know, music did it for me, but that's just another one of those things, right? Dance, music, movement, substances. These are all just like core human things that can get you there. And usually if there's traditions that are trying to repress any of those things, they're looking to keep a wall between you and the connection to the divine, so they can mediate it and be in charge.
I gotta apologize for accusing you of being raised Mormon. There's something very Mormon of me, like retroactively making you a Mormon. I mean, that's the whole hit and caboodle that's going on in Mormon temples, is they're baptizing people that are dead to be Mormon. So I apologize for. I don't know why that got in my head. I I'm sorry.
Don't take offense. Don't take offense.
Okay.
I mean.
Bunch, so I feel like that's kind of a compliment, you know.
Yeah, no kidding, right? We know what we're up to. So Rebecca, tell us about yours.
Andrew, you really dodged the personal nature of that question.
Sorry,
we can dive right back in. We're fine, you know.
I'm really happy to go back to that.
Yeah, and dive right back in.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think you're kind of like, you know, maybe part of this question relates to like your, you know, the sort of origins of your spiritual life. So that's how I'm going to answer it, if that's okay. But
perfect.
I was raised pretty Jewish. I went to, partially religious school for the entirety of my K-12 years. So there was a lot of indoctrination that goes along with that, both religious and also political as well, which, it's interesting when I think back on experiences throughout my early life where I felt connected, where I felt moved. What I recognize is that those were during meditation. They were not during prayer or religious study, or even when I was in Israel. I would say when I was in Israel, I was about 17 years old, and I've certainly moved by, you know, the 18-year-old soldiers in uniform, but not necessarily religiously or spiritually moved, right? And so I was, I can reflect back and see like that the spiritual part of the religion didn't speak to me so much. You know, I also had sort of college experiences with psychedelics that I viewed as being dangerous and harmful for many, many years. And when I would think back on those experiences, and I don't know, I had like some kind of somatic response even well after those, you know, well after those experiences occurred. And I would think to myself like, oh, you know, you see that you did something to your body, you ruined something in your brain. And so at some point, you know, I think as I'm a psychotherapist, that's my profession. And at some point I kind of understood that everything that I was doing with mindfulness, with yoga, actually had something to do with psychedelics as well. And this was around the time, this was very recent, very soon after Michael Pollan's book was published. And there was beginning to be more training opportunities for therapists. So from there, a few things happened. I think I had the opportunity to do training, experiential training with psychedelics, with ketamine specifically, which is something that I now do in my practice because it's a legal prescribable medicine. And what that experience and others did for me was it really brought together, first of all, my own personal experiences, which I then reconceptualized in a much different way, which felt a lot better than thinking that I had put a hole in my brain or whatever garbage I was being fed when I was in college. It also allowed me to re-tap into this sense of spirituality that I had felt from, you know, earlier experiences and then, you know, subsequent experiences in mindfulness, and really deepen that and also bring it into my work. So, you know, this yoga use, you know, to yoke, to bring things together, like this really happened for me in the last couple of years since I've been in this field. So it's been quite a beautiful journey for me. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. And I can relate to a lot, both what you, Andrew, said and Rebecca about, well, Rebecca, you were talking about recontextualizing. And for me, it was a lot of recontextualizing my spiritual experiences as a Mormon and reframing those because I didn't know what to do with those at the time. And Andrew, you know, to your point about like psychedelics can enhance the spiritual experience. I mean, so after leaving Mormonism, I'd gotten into yoga a little bit. I tried it out and I'm like, I just don't quite get it, you know, or I was doing meditation, but it was very like, I would turn on the Headspace app and do, which is a great app, by the way, but it was kind of like the corporate Headspace kind of thing, like reduce stress. And then after psychedelics, it just blew the doors wide open on all of that. And now like I do yoga and I just get in the flow and now I can just like lay on my bed and meditate and drop in. And just enhancing all these other practices, which, yeah, you don't need psychedelics to have a spiritual practice or to get in touch with your core, but damn, do they help. and then they enhance it. So even if you just do psychedelics for a little bit and kind of tune in with that, I feel like those practices have been enhanced for the rest of my life, the non, you know, psychoactive, I guess, mm-hmm. practices. But, and mm-hmm. so, yeah, thank you, plant medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. It's funny how similar these stories, you know, to the point of in the first couple of episodes that we did of this podcast, we almost in like this act of defiance, Mike, I don't know if you remember this, we reclaimed the term spirituality because we were having all these experiences that, you know, after turning away from such a dogmatic, high demand religion, you know, you go into this atheism and it's all, mm-hmm. it's all very reason and pragmatism and all that kind of stuff. And so spirituality was almost like a vulgar curse word to both of us. Mm-hmm. And the number of spiritual experiences I've had has just, grown exponentially as I see my connection with the divine and as I see my connection with the earth and humanity and all of life. But that's been a thing that we had to, in almost a ceremonial way, reclaim, because I think that we are very spiritual beings. But this idea of, I mean, I even asked it. I asked you all, what religion were you raised in? And when, we all had this, different answer. And it's like, that's a way to divide us all up and kind of categorize us all a little bit. And I just kind of had always used religion and spirituality synonymously. But I'm more and more, I'm learning that a spiritual practice is key. I mean, it's saved my life. And it's so funny, the similarities. I mean, it starts with, I start going to therapy, and then my therapist recommended How to Change Your Mind by Pollan. And I came back to her and was like, okay, how do I get my hands on some of this stuff? And she was like, start with yoga. So I started doing yoga and found ways to actually drop into my body and really alter my consciousness without use of medicine, and started to recognize what that was and what that looks like. And it's almost like this, like, it's like the plants have a mind of their own as they prepare us for this shit. You know, it's, we go through these steps of getting us closer to being open to it. Because when I left Mormonism and was thinking about trying alcohol at 32 years old, there's no way I would have thought to myself, ever in my life would I do a drug, okay, I'll maybe drink coffee and have a beer, but no chance will I ever do a drug, ever. Mm. And because that's the way it was framed for me, and that's what we're, I think that goes back to exactly what the both of you do with plant parenthood, right? It's framing those conversations with, I don't know, who are your clients? I mean, is it husbands and is it spouses? Is it parents and children? What do you mostly see? I know I tend to ramble and then ask some god awful question at the end. That's just who I am.
I want to say one thing before I answer that question, which is like, and maybe it's obvious and we say it all the time, I just like keep repeating it until folks get it. Alcohol is a drug. Alcohol is a really strong drug that does a lot of damage.
Yeah.
It's a drug.
One of the most dangerous drugs.
Caffeine's a drug too. Yeah. Caffeine's a drug too. You can overdose on caffeine. I mean, it's rare, but like there are lethal doses of it. A lot of folks are like, run their addictions from caffeine to their addictions to alcohol on the daily. And this is not to demonize the use of those things, because they can be used, intentionally and with moderation, but it's like, we just got to keep repeating this, because that's just propaganda bullshit that like, mushrooms are a drug the way you said it with like capital D, and that like alcohol is not, it's just bullshit. And so yeah. just got to keep repeating that until folks get it. Just because one of them is sanctioned and really profitable does not, like, that's the difference. It's not a drug. So just getting that little rant out of the way.
Well, and thank you for saying it, because I'm on a podcast called Mormons on Mushrooms, but I still have this thing of like, oh, I can talk openly about alcohol. Alcohol is one of the most harmful drugs there is. And it's one of the most abused drugs there is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So thank you for saying that.
Rebecca, you want to talk about who comes to our...
I think mainly we see parents in different age groups. We've had some grandparents. In our last integration circle, we had a bunch of kids there, sweet little babies bopping their heads around, which was really, really sweet and just kind of like perfectly encapsulated that destigmatizing, thing that we're trying to do. It's like, if I could talk about this right here and you can listen in and all this is normal, then here we go, from the time you're a baby. Mm-hmm. You can just like make this normal. But I was actually going to pick up, Doug, on something, you were talking about before. We hear this so much in our integration circle about people who are moved to try and create a spiritual life for their children outside of the context of religion, which is hard and effortful. And religion exists, I think, for a reason, because it gives us the container with the ritual and with the community gathering and with the substances, by the way, right? Like for many religions, and with the structure, like the literal, the building, right? You go to the place, your people are there and you sit down and this is what you do, right? So it kind of like is built in, it makes it a little bit easy for us. And I think from so many people who find themselves, either not moved by that, or in some cases really kind of like repulsed by that for one reason or another, as you said, like there can be this like pendulum swing hard to the other side of like atheism, pragmatism, but there is something missing in that, right? There is a connectivity, there is a meaning, there is, you know, just a depth of life that you might miss out on if that's all there is. So I think one thing that's sticking out to me as you were talking about this is that these substances, you know, psychedelics often are an entree back into spiritual life. And then the question becomes, so what do I do with that? You know, we are not, you know, I don't, most of the people who come visit with us are not, you know, indigenous people. So they don't have that, you know, built-in container of you take the plant medicine, you know, in this context, everybody's present. And even a lot of indigenous people, like that's not part of their practice either. It just really depends. So then what, you know, becomes the question. We really get stumble into that area a lot. And I think that there's, at least from what we've accessed, I think there's more and more people who are seeking something outside of religion that encompasses a lot of elements from ceremony, from ritual around plant medicine that their children can participate in with or without the plant medicine, you know? So this is something that we have talked about a lot, is kind of creating this ceremony without necessarily the plant medicine experience. So what are the elements of ceremony? So you've got maybe it's ties to nature, right? Connection to nature, intergenerational ancestral connections. You've got the sensual elements, you know, the food, the scent, you know, something tactile, maybe music, right? So all these things kind of coming together, and maybe some people are definitely talking to us about how plant medicine is also involved in that, but not necessarily. So I like what you said was resonating with what we hear in our group.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's important to think about what kind of container you want to create for it, because, you know, we are wired to connect to each other through ritual and through symbol and through those kinds of practices that involve the senses, you know, involve sound. And that is something that has also survived and been passed down. And one of the reasons that religions have survived is that, like, people do need that. And so if you're going to, or if you're in a position where you need to discard all of those elements because they're of some kind of like dogma or because of some kind of like rigidity that's also embedded in that structure or religion that you came up in, you do need to sort of fill those holes again. And just having the experience or just having a psychedelic experience is not necessarily gonna fill those gaps, right? We need to fill them with something. And it can become a problem when someone doesn't have those reference points and then they open up their consciousness and then they're like, well, that's like, that was a lie. Who am I now? What do I have to hold on to? And who do I have to hold on to? And especially for folks who, if you've left a church and, you know, there's a kind of culture of like excommunication or shunning or whatever it is, where it's like, you actually don't have those lifelines anymore. It becomes really important to have something else that you can hold on to that's connected to other people. That's not, you know, I talked about your sort of personal connection to the divine, and that's great, but they're also, you know, and for some people they can go and be a monk and that works. But for a lot of us, you know, we need to go back into the world. We need to have a relationship with our families and our communities and stuff. And so, you know, being intentional about what are those other things that you're going to do? What are those rituals and symbols you're going to, and structures you're going to put into your life and maybe share with your kids or your neighbor, whatever it is. And that could be like, we play music together on Sundays, you know, or like we all put our phones away and we cook a meal together, or, you know, we go and we look at the start. I mean, these are not necessarily complicated things, but they are things that like increasingly are kind of, unfortunately, we're deficient in as civilization. So yeah, I do think it's important if you're going to rebuild that spiritual life to try and bring those elements back in. And there's nothing to say that you can't take things back that were part of the religion you came up in if they're valuable. You know what I mean? Like, they belong to you and God, and like, someone else is using them in a way that's like serving some other end that's not what you're into. That's their problem. Like, you can take Jesus back if you want and yes. do it. Like, I do it all the time. Like, I write dirty poems about Jesus and I feel great about it.
Fuck yeah, like dude. Yes. Dude, Jesus is like kind of dope, huh? Like, I feel like
or Jesus, Buddha, or, you know, yeah. like to me, they're the same stories. Like,
yeah.
Different, you know, different masks.
Well, there's so much we could say. Holy shit. One, I want to hear you recite one of the poems.
Same.
But two,
I want to hear a dirty poem about Jesus. I didn't know I needed that in my life until just right now.
Same.
Think about it.
Okay.
There is something about that community aspect. So I was actually talking to, and maybe a question I do want to hit on, because we talked about talking to your kids about psychedelics, but there's also what we're dealing with in our community is also talking to spouses who still feel like coffee is going to send you to hell, or parents who might have a similar belief, you know, and I think a lot of the things you, especially, you know, not approaching it with an energy of confession. There are things we've already talked about, and talking to your kids might be similar to talking to a family member or a spouse or parent. But I was talking to a family member. I went back to Utah last weekend for my dad's 70th birthday, and I was talking to a family member. They were talking about a neighbor of theirs who'd left the church, and how that neighbor was talking to them and said, "We had such a community here," and they're in the heart of like the most Mormon part of the most Mormon state. Right. And when we left, there was no one to welcome us in. There was no one, you know, we go to church and people welcome you, or, you know, you go to, if you're an investigator in a Mormon church, you're going to walk in the doors and people are going to come up and be like, "Hey, what's your story?" You know, come and put their arms around you because they want to bring you in. Thankfully, online communities have taken some of this role of, you know, there are a lot of online ex-Mormon communities, but for people who are leaving the church and don't know where to go, it can feel like you just left a community where all your neighbors across the street are going, and now you don't have that. And you miss that, you know, as boring as Mormon church hymns are, there's something beautiful about being in a group of people and singing or doing rituals or, you know, just rites of passage, being there when your neighbor's 8-year-old gets baptized, you know, being there and celebrating their 8-year-old, not necessarily for the sense of they're being baptized, but celebrating a rite of passage at, you know, and the different milestones. And we miss that when we leave the community. And I love how you guys said, it's okay to take some of that back and reclaim some of that.
Yeah. I love that.
Virtual community will not replace that. You know, there are some serious limitations to the work that we're doing because it is virtual, because we are reaching a national and even international audience. And there is no replacement for walking into a space and receiving a hug from someone. So we know that, you know, the local psychedelic societies can play a role in having that sort of human face-to-face contact. And so for some of these more niche conversations like you all are having and we're having, it helps to, you know, kind of be expansive like that. But, you know, this is not the same. Like, and there's a piece of this sort of digital age that's really beautiful. And then there's a piece that's just like, oh, this ain't it, right? Like, there's a lot more to it. When we think about psychedelic work in the context that Andrew and I teach, we have made the work so hyper individual. I mean, it's literally like, I mean, there's a relational aspect. So there's, it's me and my therapist or my co-therapist, but I'm blindfolded. I'm inside of my own mind. So then the work becomes about the self and improving the self. And that is wonderful. And that's where, you know, most people who access this work therapeutically tend to start there. What I see in my private practice is that work, it has outer limits. You know, you will reach a point at which you can't work on that shit anymore. Like, you have to expand it. And the next natural expansion is into the family structure. And then beyond that, into community. And beyond that, right? So we have these like expansive bubbles. But when we just think about psychedelic work in terms of the individual, we are really missing a piece of the puzzle. And we have to be quite, I look at all of this research about the individual in a very individual context that we're looking at. And that's just, yeah, we're missing some things.
So with that in mind, I would like to just explore a little bit, because, you know, people have, a lot of people are dealing with that within their own families, you know, or their community, this rift of leaving Mormonism. And now, you know, explaining to them, you know, I had to recently explain to my parents, my psychedelic use, and, you know, my family learned that I have a podcast about the podcast. I was able to keep it from them for a while. I didn't open up to them about it and they found out. Yeah. Any other tips on how to approach those conversations, I guess? It may be a conversation where a close family member, maybe even a spouse, like you're wanting to do psychedelics or you are using them, and how to navigate that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I know you have thoughts on that, Andrew.
Yeah. It really depends on who you're dealing with and like what the context is or what the relationship is, right? Like, I can't necessarily speculate if there's a couple who's like, if you have a couple and they're really tight and there's like good open communication and support and trust, but this is a topic that they kind of like differ on. That's quite different than someone who's like, you know, maybe somewhat like of a closed or not a very open channel relationship with like, say, their parents or something. And there's already some sort of judgmental kind of rift there. So I think it starts with just like your relationship with yourself. Like, you know, Mike, I think early in the conversation, you were alluding to, you know, kids being able to, or like suggesting maybe this is a bit woo. I don't think it's woo at all. Like, kids are very intuitive. They pick up on all of the unsaid stuff that your nervous system is expressing or that your body is expressing, or that it's just not necessarily coming out in words, but it's coming out, like it's there. And that's true for us as animals in general. Like, if you're not grounded with your own shit, you're not clear on where you stand, that's going to make those conversations a bit trickier. Someone else, if they have doubt, or if they have judgment, or there's all these things that they're holding on to that's attached to their stories, and then you're trying to come into a conversation with them or trying to communicate this, that part of them is going to pick up on the part of you that's unsure and that's scared, right? So that's the place to start. It's like, where am I with this stuff? And then like, once you're solid there, then it's just a question of like putting it out there and having trust that like what comes back is what's going to need to come back for that relationship to continue to evolve. It might make that relationship harder in the shorter term, but it's not going to get stuck in a lie and die, you know, which is kind of the alternative. It's like you put something in a box and you just kind of don't push it further. And some relationships might need to do that. And some are going to, that's going to be a catalyst, or that's going to be some kind of chemical reaction. And then maybe that's going to shift them. Maybe that's going to put them on a different path and they're going to learn something new. You know, that's the only way to do this. It's like, get clear with your own stuff and then just be brave and put it out there and take the chance.
I love that. Cause when you're clear with your own stuff, you're not trying to control their reaction. It's like, let their reaction be whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And their reaction has nothing to do with your truth. I even think of it in terms of if a loved one, whether it be a spouse or a parent or something, is taking issue with your psychedelic use and it's triggering something in you, they're probably just reflecting back as a mirror some of your own unconscious beliefs and fears and there are plenty of them. If you've grown up in Mormonism and you think coffee is going to send you to hell, when you're going down a psychedelic path or taking some of these substances that we call drugs, you know, and you've learned in Red Ribbon Week and through the DARE program, just how, you know, say no to drugs, your subconscious received all those messages. And whether you consciously think, no, I'm safe, I'm this, you've read Michael Pollan, you've listened to podcasts, you think you're fine, there's a part of you that might be terrified. And maybe your spouse or your parent is just reflecting back to you that own part of you that is terrified. And so, yeah, owning that and letting it be there and not, I got an image of you just stating your truth and letting their reaction be what it is. Don't try to state it in a way that like to mitigate their reaction or to control it. Just let it be. And then let them work through that. And is any of this making sense?
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's just the image I got when you were talking, Andrew, and I loved it.
Well, you're just articulating kind of like healthy communication strategies, right? Validate for the other, like validate the other person's position. And, you know, if they're uncomfortable or worried about something, they're allowed to be. And like, you can also just be transparent about your own process. And if there's stuff that you're not clear on, be like, yeah. And like, I was a bit worried about this or that. And then this has been my experience, you know, that creates an opportunity for them to connect too, and to sort of see themselves in you. And it opens things up rather than shuts them down.
Yeah. Just one more point on that. When I told my parents about using psychedelics, I'd had a good session with my therapist before, so I was well prepped as far as this goes, but like they expressed a lot of fear about this and about where I'm going. And basically I felt good that I was able to validate that. And I said, Mom, Dad, like I'm scared too, in a way. Like this is so different from anything I was raised with as far as like black and white. This is very, it's not black and white anymore. And I get scared, but, and this is where I think it was able to really help, as I said, but I was raised, I still have the values that you raised me with, the values of being responsible, the values of loving my family and owning my truth and owning my shit. I don't think I said shit in the conversation with my parents, but you know, but basically just like, I appreciate everything you've taught me, and everything you've taught me is helping me in this moment, even when things seem scary and gray and dark and different and new. But I'm taking all these tools with me, and thank you for teaching me these things. But just acknowledging to them that, look, yeah, I'm scared too, but I'm okay. I'm doing okay. I'm doing great, actually, you know, and reiterating that, really, I think it really helped. Anyway, I brought that up when you were saying that.
It sounds like there was sort of this moment of connection in that conversation, which is really beautiful, or maybe like a different way of understanding or different resonance there. I want to say that, you know, that experience that you had, Mike, sounds really healthy for you. And the reason that we think about this, and Andrew, you started by saying like, this is such an individual decision that we tend not to be too prescriptive about this, because what if there's abuse, right? Like what if there is trauma that makes the audience actually unsafe? And also, who are you? Who is the speaker, right? Is the speaker somebody who's going through a custody battle, and the awareness of their or something getting out about their drug use would jeopardize their custody of their children? Is the person being disproportionately monitored by the criminal justice system or the education system or the healthcare system, as people with black and brown skin are? Like, who's the speaker? And to what degree of privilege are they walking around disclosing this to other people? So that becomes something that it becomes really hard to answer the question of disclosure, you know, even though it can lead to these really beautiful moments of understanding or stepping into our own truths. It really depends.
Which speaks to the need of a community too, in a way, right? Because
back to that, yeah.
Yeah, those sessions, like you guys have, you know, group sessions with Planned Parenthood, and really leaning on a community to help you to bounce ideas off, because there is no one size fits all. There's no one like set of advice we could give to every situation. But if you have that support and people to lean on, it can make all the difference, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your community too, right? Like, I mean, I know that both of ours are intended as intentionally safe, non-judgmental spaces. I know from our experience, like we tear up in these integration circles all the time. I'm like wiping tears because I know that this is the first time that somebody is saying this stuff. And I know that this is the first space that they could say it and not feel worried. And people say some stuff that even I'm like, ooh, wow, I'm kind of surprised that you revealed this, but I'm glad that you did, right? Because it's like when you have a truly safe community where you can say anything, you know, what happens, I think, is that you feel held enough that you can receive feedback in a different way. Like Mike, you were just saying, like you could receive that feedback from your parents because it was safe enough. And so that's what we're trying to create also, is a space that's safe enough that you can say something that is so, you know, whatever that, but it needs to be said so that you can get the bounce back. How are other people going to respond to that? Because if it's you in your own mind making decisions in isolation, I think that leads us to places that are probably not so good and certainly leads us to a lot of shame. Was that a non sequitur? Nobody has anything.
No, I'm thinking a lot about that. Sorry. So Rebecca, we do, within our little community, we do some, share circle type of things. And, they do tend to, you know, it really hit me when you were talking about, you know, people will share some stuff that it's a gut punch sometimes where I'm just like, whoa, wait a minute here. Like this is going somewhere that I don't feel like I've got the emotional tools or certifications or training to help with this. God, it just speaks to that need for community and social human contact and trying to bring people together in a way that we are a social animal. I mean, we're a pack animal, you know? And sometimes those shares get into a place where I really do feel like I don't know that person's ever said that before in public or to a group of people. And it gets real serious. And I, you know, you all are like, I got the biggest old crush on all three of you right now, just talking about the therapeutic nature of this stuff. And sometimes I tend to not go as deep as what you're talking about. I tended to have fun with it a lot of the time. And I guess I'm curious about that too, because I really do look at these plants as a lifesaver for me. You know, my life's trajectory was in a different sort of way. I am not, I'm a big old douchebag in a lot of ways, you know? And
like you.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm fun to be around, but you know, there is that, like that balance. I know I'm not getting to a point here, but it's circling around in my head of Rebecca, you just rattled some stuff loose in me it's not binary. And these things can exist in a way that open us up to be able to say what is inside of us that we would never say to a group of people before in our whole lives. And there is a healing nature to that. And there's a therapeutic nature to that. And it also does not negate. I sound probably a little quixotic right now of just like, I'm a little idealistic, but there's also not this negation of just really feeling the most alive and dancing and music. Andrew, you keep talking about music and I feel like you're probably a bomb ass musician and I want to hear your tunes, man. And these do not have to be polarizing experiences, right? This idea of exploring that space and enjoying it and having fun can also lead to some big revelatory, heart changing moments and experiences. Or, and I guess here comes the question, because I just talked for 45 minutes, but or does it have to be separate? Do we have to do it ceremonial and we're doing it for therapeutic benefit and we're going to get real serious about this? And how dare you recreationally have any kind of fun with it? Can they exist Can they coexist? That's my fucking question.
Of course they do. They have to. Yes. Yes. Of course. They're to say that they exist in silos is preposterous. And if you've been to a ceremony, you're going to be having fun at some point during that weekend retreat, right? Like there is plenty of fun there. It's not, you know, especially I think parents who face a lot of pressure. It's like, okay, once you have your kid, shut your whole fun zone of your brain down, because now you got to be responsible. But you know, with your brain. Oh, sorry. Was there something else that you were thinking of?
Brain's not where I have fun. Turn the brain off.
Yeah,
they can coexist. I wanna point to something, and then we'll come back to the fun. But you know, when Rebecca's talking about this sharing and kind of this intensity of this stuff that people are like holding, you know, or that wouldn't normally share, like I'm thinking also of just the reason for religion, or the reason for having that community connection is so that we can share that the burden of being alive and how terrifying it is and how painful it is. And that like so many of our communities and like institutions that are supposed to provide that support don't. They just whitewash the whole thing and make it really sterile and pretend that everyone's there to support each other. But then when shit gets really dark and heavy, people don't want to know about it. They don't want to look at it. They don't want to see that death is real. They don't want to see that sex is real, right? They want to put the dirty stuff away, keep it in the corner. And then like, you can't do that. You can't do that and then have the actual joy and pleasure and all of the good stuff. So you kind of, you get everything atrophies. And so, like, to me, it's like, it's not just like, can the fun coexist with the therapeutic, but it's like the pain, you got to be able to hold the pain together. So to experience the other stuff too. And the really hard stuff, like raising children, like dealing with parents, like getting old and dying, or like being sick or falling in love, like all these things, it's like, the entire experience of that is like on you to hold by yourself, or in a tiny nuclear or just in a nuclear family, you're going to go crazy. And like, that's what's so moving also about some of these circles is like, and especially over the last year during COVID, is just like these parents and like single parents with like neurodivergent children, or like, you know, they're like, there's like really like juggling some difficult shit. And like everyone deals with difficult stuff at some point, you know, or there's like someone's dying or what, like whatever it is. And it's like, just actually being able to share that, just being able to put that on the table, and like someone else is like right there showing up for it, and they're going through something else, is like, it's not that complicated. But man, we are really lacking in spaces to do that. So like, for me, it's like creating that space where you can put that stuff out there is like that foundational thing. And then you can build on that. Once you get that stuff out in the, open, then you can like, actually it ends up, you know, diversifying the space. It's not just something stale that's locked in a box somewhere. It's like you open a window, air circulates and everyone can breathe and you'd start singing and whatever, something good happens, you know? Yeah. To me, it's like the yes, fun and therapy can coexist, but I think more importantly is like you gotta get into the gnarly shit if you want to really like be alive.
Way to put a drain on the question about fun, Andrew.
sorry.
But you know, that's so, sorry, Mike, I'm gonna take another turn here, but like, so Mike and I did DMT recently together, and you know, with DMT, I was like, okay, I'm going to go into it, and I got intentions, and I'm going to learn some shit, and I'm going to really do it, you know? And then Mike, you know, I went into the weird realm with the machine elves, or what do we call them? And they were just like, no, dude, let's just dance. Like, when they were doing like all those dance moves for me and they were like kind of having a good time. And I was just like watching like, oh, I can just dance. I don't have to go deep and have all these intent. They were like, no, check it out. We can dance to any kind of music. Like the music we're playing was like sitar music or something. I don't know. It was like, you know, whatever the fuck that was, Mike. I don't know what it was, but they were like, look, watch us dance to this. It doesn't matter. And I was like, holy shit. You don't know what you're going to get. And you can just kind of heal from that part of it too, of just like, yeah, maybe it's time to just dance. Mm-hmm. Give me Celine Dion. I'll dance to it, man. I could dance to anything, whatever. I'm ready. Were you raising your hand because you like, I secretly love
Celine. I love Celine Dion. We had a conversation. Andrew and I had a private conversation about Celine Dion. He respects the fact that I like Celine Dion.
Well, I mean, he's cool. He's over here talking about Jerry Garcia and Leonard Cohen and stuff like that. Like he's like, you know, Johnny Music over there. And I like those two. I like those dudes too. But like, listen, Celine Dion sing The Power of Love, I will cry 10 times out of 10. Like, bring it on.
There's a great book in the 33 and a third series. It's called Let's Talk About Love. It's by a music critic named Carl Wilson, who's a friend. And it's all about Celine Dion and musical taste and how important it is not to judge people's taste. It's about, I saw shout out to Let's Talk About Love about Celine Dion.
Let's talk about
who's love. From my hometown. Who's from my home? You know, from Quebec. She's one of our greatest exports. So,
you all didn't think we were going to be talking about Celine Dion tonight, did you?
I like this fun thing. I mean, I think like what you're pointing to is like not just the fun, but going like shooting past all the stories and the egos and narratives and just getting to the point where it's kind of absurd. That's also doable. It's like, you know, at a certain point you scale back far enough. Like sometimes you scale back enough to see like how insignificant you are or how significant you are relative to all these other stories. And it helps kind of rearrange things and make them easier to deal with. Like sometimes you blast all the way and all the way through. And it's like everyone's just kind of this like, or the whole universe is just this sort of like blip on the blip of another blip. And it just seems kind of stupid to worry about it. That can also happen. The utility of that is usually kind of short lived and you come crashing back into your body and your being and your ego and stuff like that. So I've definitely had those experiences and know what you're talking about. But I think like when you're talking about the usefulness of it, sometimes there's a question there. I'm not always sure there's like enlightenment's that useful while you're still incarnated in a human body. It can be really interesting.
Well, it brings me back to what you were saying, Andrew, about like being a monk, right? Earlier, I think. And yeah, we could be a monk and go live in a monastery and find it all within us and find like the universe all exists in here and here. But it's like, but if that's what we're doing here, why did we come here? You know? And if we wanted just to blast off and like, this is all meaningless and this, or do we come? Cause like, yeah, we want experience in the death and the sex and the dirt and the muck and the play and experience it, you know, embody it and live it and embrace it. But
yeah. I don't have the answer to that question yet. I'm working on that one.
Same.
This is kind of a piece that kind of relates a little bit back to Planned Parenthood is what you're talking about, Mike, that sort of embodiment of all of these very human experiences. You know, our kids, especially our young kids, they know how to do that so much better than we do. And we are, I think a lot of the work that people are doing in taking the psychedelic is to re-engage with that and to find that again, you know, through this altered state. When we think about integrating that stuff, we talk about how, you know, play with young kids is such a beautiful practice of integration because they are lost in their world. They are completely immersed in play in ways that we have so much trouble with, you know, because of all the distractions that we are exposed to and all the ways that our mind cannot, you know, get into that level of fixation that theirs can. So anyways, you made me think of that when we're talking about play and fun.
I think we probably told you like an hour and a half and we're coming up on 2 hours. Do you guys just want to keep talking for another 4 hours? I wasn't kidding.
No, I gotta go to bed in 10 minutes, but I'm booked for the next 15 with you guys. We can keep going for a few more.
Yeah. Holy smoke.
Oh, this has been great, you guys. So I just want you to, before we wrap it fully up, I want you to kind of touch a little bit more. So we talked about online share circles. What other resources can people find through Planned Parenthood?
So we have, the main way that we communicate with people is through our newsletter and through Instagram. So our website is www.plantph.com, where you can find links to a lot of the work that we're talking about that we've produce these, some of these videos and interviews, articles, and then also Instagram/Facebook, where we put a lot of our work there, as well as, you know, announcing events that we're doing, things like that.
I mean, all the social links are on the website. Folks can sign up for our newsletter. We're still working on other ideas. We do have a workshop that we give on psychedelic kind of integration. I think we're going to post another one of those at some point soon. That's about it for now. But I mean, we always encourage folks to reach out. There's stuff that they would like to see or do, or hopefully have some in-person events again soon. I think we might do something in New York in December, but obviously harder to do with communities spread out all over the place, but always happy to try and support that in some capacity or another. As we talked about today, there's really no replacement for that kind of connection and community.
I mean, we're dealing with kind of the same stuff. I mean, we launched our podcast during COVID. We had kind of an event through the, it's called the Divine Assembly. It's a kind of an ethnogenic church that was founded in Utah by an ex-Mormon. They put on like a little rave like thing over the solstice. That was like our first, like we hosted a camp there, and that was our first in-person thing, and it was super rad. But really it's just been online, you know, through like our Facebook community, our Mighty Networks community. And so we're in the same boat where it's like we want to start doing more live things and more in-person events, which I'm going to be in Austin in a month, and I want to like at least do a little get together there with some people that are listening there. So just a little plug for that. And yeah, we want to start doing more of that. And so I just plug our own stuff.
maybe we'll do a crossover event someday.
That's right. Please. Are you all coming to Horizons? Are you going to be there?
What is Horizons?
This is the first I'm hearing about it. So,
well, it's a big one. It's the longest running psychedelic conference, and I think one of the best ones. A mixture of science and culture. The culture being perhaps the thing that keeps you a little bit more awake during conferences like this, but it's in December, it's in New York. We're a community partner of Horizons as well, so I guess I'm plugging them, but it's super fun and in person, lots of fun parties afterwards as well.
Well, Doug, do we have to go? I think we have to go.
I'm interested in going. Yeah.
or we could do Las Vegas next year for whatever the Vegas one is that's coming up. That looks pretty cool. Probably closer to you guys.
Tripping in Vegas is
you have
tough.
To go to Vegas.
Yeah, tripping in Vegas.
I've never been there.
It's a tough, go. Like Hunter Thompson was not. I mean, his book's pretty dead on about it, but like tripping in Vegas is a fucking.
I didn't say anything about tripping. I just said community event.
I'm tripping. I'm going. If I'm going, I'm gonna trip.
I see us all tripping together in the future. So that's going to be rad. I'm going to manifest it right now. So, but we can't thank you guys enough. You guys are fucking rad and doing some great work. Yeah. I don't know. I've loved this conversation so much.
Really, really loved it. Yeah.
I hope the conversation is useful for your listeners.
Big
you know,
time.
Especially so helpful. Especially any of those that are kind of on the fence or in more of a transitional period. I know it's going to be challenging to be able to, you know, move out of the safe confines of a nevertheless restrictive kind of high demand group or community and into some scarier space. So anyway, thanks for the work you guys are doing too. It's important.
So okay. Sweet.
Thanks y'all.
All right, guys. Have a good night. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to Mormons on Mushrooms podcast. We have so much fun recording it. And if you love it, we would absolutely love it if you could leave a review on wherever you get your podcasts. It would really help our visibility so more people can listen to it and be enlightened and hear our crazy stories. So thanks again for tuning in.